We're beginning tonight a study of the first 11 chapters of the Gospel of John. John is in many ways the most beloved of the four Gospels, even though we all love Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and so does everyone else. John seems to be the one that people love more than any other, and there's a lot of different reasons for that. It's very simple on one level, the stories that are told, the miracles that are recorded, the teachings of Jesus, and yet woven in with that simple story is some of the most profound theology in the entire New Testament, in fact, in the whole Bible, because it all revolves around who Jesus is. And one of the commentaries I have written by a man by the name of Mark Guzik, he says, and this is a paraphrase that I have of what he said, Matthew shows us Jesus as the Messianic King. Mark shows us Jesus as the perfect servant that's talked about in the Old Testament who would come. Luke shows us Jesus as the perfect sinless man that people of all races and cultures can relate to. But John shows us that Jesus was God incarnate. And that's the emphasis of the Gospel of John. I've preached from John numerous times, but my love affair with the Gospel of John goes all the way back to when I was in college at Florida College in 1969 and 70. And my instructor for the Gospel of John was a man by the name of Homer Haley, and someone that also Brother Nat had as an instructor when he was there, and I can name numerous others. If Brother Ed Wharton was here, every time we get together, we have to swap Homer Haley stories with each other. That was also true of Brother Doyle Gillum, who taught the Gospel of John in the Sunset School here for years and years. He went to Florida College and sat at the feet of Brother Homer Haley as well. Richard Rogers did the same. Abe Lincoln did the same. Many of us connect directly with Brother Haley. And so my first understanding of John as how different it was from the other Gospels comes from sitting at the feet of Brother Homer Haley. And shortly after I had him, and before he retired, he actually put out a book that covered the same material, more or less, that we covered in that class called That You May Believe, a commentary on the Gospel of John. But unfortunately, it's now out of print. Brother Haley passed away a number of years ago, and, things change. And but fortunately, I only have four copies of it, as far as I know. So I'm well set probably for the rest of my life anyway. Tonight we want to just introduce the book and some things about it. And then starting next week, we'll try each week to cover one chapter just in more of a survey. Next week we'll cover chapter 1, the next week chapter 2, and the last week we should be at chapter 11 then. Okay, the author. Just like the other Gospels, the Gospel of John does not say anywhere in it who wrote it in terms of giving a name. It's not like the epistles of Paul or of Peter or even the epistles of John that start out by saying that this is who the author is. Even the book of Revelation does that. But none of the four Gospels do that. And while modern critical scholars who judge things from the past by what they think today ought to be criticize the Gospels for that, saying, well, this just proves they really weren't from the original disciples and followers of Jesus, but were written at a later time by other people and who basically falsified the whole concept of who the real authors was. But real scholarship has really cast aside those kind of aspersions on the Gospels, including the Gospel of John. And there's two basic areas in which we, along with scholars today, look at to determine who was the author. First of all, is from the evidence inside the book itself. Numerous times inside the book of John, we will run across the statement, especially hopefully next October, November, December, when we cover the second half of the book, we will hear the author referring to someone as the disciple whom Jesus loved, including very near the end of the book, in two different places where it says it's the disciple whom Jesus loved who saw these things, and that's how we can know they're true. So how do we determine who this person is described as the disciple whom Jesus loved? Well, here's how the reasoning goes. In Jesus's group of core disciples, what we call the 12 apostles, we know what happened to one of them, Judas. He was a traitor, and he killed himself about the same time Jesus died, just within a day, you know, a few hours before, or a day, at the most, a day after Jesus died, he kills himself. But of those 11 that remain, we know the scriptures keep identifying three of those, Peter, James, and John, as sort of an inner circle. They seem to be the ones that were the closest to Jesus. I don't know that the others felt left out at all, but they seem to be the ones that Jesus did things with, even when he didn't do it with all the 11 or the 12. For example, when he goes in to raise a young girl from the dead, he only takes three in with him, Peter, James, and John. When they're at the foot of a very high mountain and Jesus calls three of his disciples to go up on that mountain with him, and when they're up there, Jesus is transformed or transfigured in front of them, who were those three other disciples? Peter, James, and John. And yet when we read in the Gospel of John, we notice an interesting thing. Of those three disciples, the inner group, only one is ever actually mentioned by name. And he's mentioned numerous times. That's Peter. Now, maybe that's not particularly odd in and of itself. A second thing to notice is because of when it seems like this book was written, probably sometime after A.D. 70, towards the end of the first century somewhere. By that period of time, after A.D. 70, as far as history records, all the other apostles were already dead by that time. In fact, James, the second member of that group, Peter, James, and John, James was actually the first of the apostles to die, and we have that recorded in the book of Acts. So he died very early after Jesus returned to heaven and the apostles began their work. That just leaves John, and yet John is never mentioned by name in this book. But now a John is mentioned, but which John is that? John the Baptist. But he's not called John the Baptist. In the other three Gospels, he's always referred to as John the Baptist, because pretty soon in the story in Matthew and Mark and Luke, another John is going to be showing up, John the Apostle. And so the other writers seem to always want to distinguish between John the Baptizer and this John, John the Apostle. But we have no mention of John the Apostle by name in this Gospel, only John the Baptist, but he's always just simply referred to as John. Scholars take this as a clue that the author is really telling us who he is without actually using his name, because the whole book, of course, except with one or two verses, is all written in the third person, as if, you know, an observer is observing everything that's happening and everything Jesus is saying, and he's recording it in the third person, he and they and so forth, instead of I and we. And so using that kind of, you know, author choice of how to write your book, then John, how does he introduce himself in? Well, he says, this is the disciple whom Jesus loved that all this information is coming from. And then there's one other little clue that maybe some people think is shaky. I think it has a good possibility of at least it being true. When you look at the women who are following Jesus, you know, there are several places where various ones are named, Mary and Salome and Mary Magdalene and so forth. In a couple of places where those people are named, in one of them you find that it mentions this lady and it says that she is the sister of Mary, the mother of Jesus. But in the parallel passage in another gospel, it actually says that that woman is the wife of Zebedee. So if the wife of Zebedee is the sister of Mary, the mother of Jesus, what would that make James and John and Jesus, first cousins. And if that is true, and that's not proven, but that seems to me a real probability, not just a possibility, then that would mean that Jesus has probably known these two other men his entire life. They in effect, almost grew up together. And so who of the 12 then would be the one most likely that he would say of himself, I'm the one that Jesus loved? John the Apostle seemed to be younger than Jesus and probably younger than most of the other apostles. While Jesus was about 30 years of age, it seems that John, and again, we rely a little bit on history and things like that, that John was probably only 20, 21, 22 by comparison, much younger man. And so he was always a young, you know, if this whole thing about cousin holds up, then he would be the one that, you know, sort of tagged along while his older brother James and Jesus was doing things, even as boys. But that's the internal, I mean, that's just sort of a brief survey of some of the internal evidence concerning who this person was. And we'll get into it a little bit more further down about how this is actually eyewitness testimony. And the second thing that's looked at concerning him is that whoever this person is, he is an eyewitness. He claims to be, and the things that he says and records are only the things that a real eyewitness could record. We can compare that or contrast that with Luke, for example, where Luke plainly says at the very beginning of his book, he was not an eyewitness, but that he had relied upon the testimony of eyewitnesses to write his gospel. But this person, whoever is writing this, is an eyewitness. And more than an eyewitness, he's very familiar with everything Jewish. Scholars say that even the way it's written, even though it's in the Greek language, that he uses Hebrew vocabulary, Hebrew ways of speech, Hebrew sentence structure, and so forth, even Hebrew ways of reasoning that is different than Matthew, Mark, and Luke's way of writing their Gospels, that he's very familiar with the Old Testament scriptures, not just the writings, but even the prophecies, the ceremonies, the practices, the beliefs, the thinking process, the emphases that people had who were Jewish at that time on things like the Sabbath day, the Passover, and so forth. So this is a person who was, seems clearly, a Jewish person and fully versed in all things Jewish. He also is very precise in many things he records in his books. He gives exact numbers, whether it's of things or days or hours or events. Like at the very end of the book, we want to get to cover in this first study, he will say very specifically that they caught 153 fish. Not just a large number, but 153. Now, Sunday morning, when I actually got to speak on this same thing, I pointed out that since John grew up as a fisherman, all fishermen know exactly how many fish they catch, even if it happened 50 years ago. Now, the only thing you have to worry about is how big they are, because they keep growing with time. But John is very precise that they got 153 fish, and that's just one of numerous examples through the gospel of how he's very precise, which is the kind of thing a eyewitness can do, because he was there to know exactly what it amounted to. And this person, as an eyewitness, was very close to one other of the apostles, and we've already made that point in another way. Who is it that goes with Peter when Jesus is being taken to trial? This person. Even though he didn't say who he is here, in the other gospel accounts, it seems to identify that, you know, it might well have been John. But beyond that, who is there on the morning when the word first comes that the tomb is empty? This disciple along with Peter, and they run together to the tomb. So it seems clear just from the internal evidence overall that this individual, the most likely candidate by far, is John the Apostle. But then we have the external evidence, as it's called, and that is going back as far in time as we can and getting as close as we can to the New Testament period of time. Is there any external evidence that John is actually the author of this book? The fact of the matter is, there is no record anywhere in early church history of anyone except John being listed as the author of this gospel. From the very earliest records we have, including a man by the name of Papias, who is thought to have been born around AD 90 and was an elder in the church in Hierapolis, he's the first and earliest record we have where he says John wrote this gospel. He's also the one that says Matthew wrote Matthew and Mark wrote Mark. And I forgot to look up whether he said Luke wrote Luke. But then after Papias, we have a whole line of other church fathers over the next several generations, all who list John as the author of this gospel. No one else is ever credited with being the author. Now, what's so interesting about these first people, like Papias, and another man by the name of Irenaeus, who lived just slightly after Papias, but in the same roughly lifetime, is both of them claim to have known a man by the name of Polycarp. And Polycarp is a man who died maybe AD 154, 55, 56, I think right in there somewhere, as a martyr. And they both claim to have known Polycarp. And why is that important? Because Polycarp, in his own writings that survive, say that when he was a young man, he was taught personally by John the Apostle. So you have this chain, you see, John, Polycarp, Papias, and Irenaeus, and this all this connection back to John the Apostle. And so we have both this internal evidence, external evidence about who the author was. Well, the date, we've already said that it's thought that it probably was written after AD 70. AD 70 is a critical time because that's when the temple in Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans that Jesus had foretold in Matthew 24. And before that time, all the apostles had already scattered out of the city and gone about their, you know, great commission work. And it is said of John, again by history, that he had moved to Ephesus and in effect picked up the work that had been left because of the death of the apostle Paul, when Paul died maybe around AD 64. And he moves to Ephesus, spends the rest of his life there. That's also where he writes the book of Revelation to the seven churches of Asia, one of which is Ephesus itself. And so this would seem to be by far the most likely time that this was written, and probably to the same people, more or less, that the book of Revelation was intended for. And what was the purpose of the book? Well, he's very clear. This is something the other three Gospels do not do. But if we go to the very end almost of the gospel in John chapter 20, we hear him saying this in verses 30 and 31. Jesus did many other miraculous signs in the presence of his disciples, which are not recorded in this book. But these are written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that by believing you may have life in his name. He's very clear that he intended this book as what we would call an apologetic. An apologetics in the Christian sphere is a presentation of the evidence to support the things we believe. And it's a defense against those who deny those things. John seems to be very clearly saying this is an apologetic from an eyewitness. For you see, these apostles had scattered out all over at least the known world at that time, along with many others, and were preaching the good news about Jesus. But why should people believe them? And what are they hearing from these apostles and evangelists that would be so convincing that they would not only become followers of Jesus, but when persecution began, they would lay down their lives rather than give up their faith? It's going to have to be something very compelling. You know, there's a lot of things in this life that we can be presented with that we say, well, you know, that sounds reasonable. I believe that. But hey, if you tell me die or give it up, I think I could give it up. You know, there's a lot of things that it's just not worth dying for. But whatever message they were hearing and whatever evidence they were presented with was so compelling that they not only accepted it and lived the rest of their lives out of it, but died for it when necessary. And that's what John is for us. And that's the way we're going to be looking at it as we study it over the next 3 months approximately, is here is an eyewitness telling people why they can believe, or as some commentators point out, when he says that you may believe, that actually the best translation of that would be that you may continue to believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, and that in believing you might continue to have life in his name. Just like John in the book of Revelation is trying to strengthen the faith of those who already were believers, it looks like he was also trying to strengthen the faith of those who were already believers in the Gospel of John, along with providing the means by which those believers can help others become believers as well. So let's, you know, I've just got a few minutes left, but some unique things we're going to see in the Gospel of John. First of all, there are obviously some real similarities with the other Gospels. The story is about the same person, isn't it? And the same basic facts are there. Jesus appeared in his ministry at the beginning, or very early in the ministry of John the Baptizer. He was a person who did miracles, that was a wonderful and amazing teacher, and that people began to think that he was the Messiah because of that. But conflict starts to arise with the religious leaders because Jesus was not supporting their traditions and their ways of thinking of things, and he was even critical of them for what they were doing and how they had mishandled God's word and how they were mistreating God's people. And that conflict and that controversy that comes out of that will end up coming to a crisis in which, when Jesus is in Jerusalem at the Passover, he will be arrested as a result of a betrayal, and he will be put on trial, and he'll be condemned to death by both the Jewish leadership and the Roman leadership, and he'll be crucified. But he rises from the dead on the third day. All four Gospels tell that same story. But there's a great deal of differences, too. The first three Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, are referred to commonly as the Synoptic Gospels. A synoptic is a technical term that, two words, syn means along the same lines as, or a parallel, and optics means to look. In many ways, Matthew, Mark, and Luke look the same. They're telling much of the same story in much of the same way. Now, they start at different places. You know, Matthew begins with the angel appearing to Joseph, the one who's engaged to be married to Mary, and picks up the story there. Mark starts with the baptism that John the Baptizer came preaching in the wilderness. He skips the birth narrative altogether. Luke picks up the birth narrative, but he starts before Matthew does by talking about John the Baptizer and the angel appearing to Zechariah in the temple and telling him that he and his wife are going to have a son who's going to be the forerunner of the Messiah. So they start in different places, but they're still very much like each other. Scholars say that, and I've never done this, but there are the books you can look up to do this, that if you just laid all three of those books down side by side and looked at the verses that are almost identical, at least in terms of what's in the content of them, that between 70% and 90% of the material in any one of the first three Gospels is in the other two also. Luke has about 30% that's unique to him. Matthew has about 20% that's unique to him. And Mark maybe has 10% or less that's found only in Mark. But when you get to John, guess what? Only 10% of what's in John is found in the other three Gospels, any one of the other three Gospels. And some 90% or more of what's in John is unique to him. That's one thing that really stands out about the Gospel of John. It's kind of unique in its arrangement as well. It starts out with a prologue, the first 18 verses of John that we'll look at next week. His is an actual introduction to the book, and what he's going to proceed to try to demonstrate as true in the rest of the book is summed up in the first 18 verses. The other Gospels don't do that. At the end of the book, we suddenly have a chapter at the end, chapter 21, that looks like it was written as sort of an appendix or an add-on to what probably was originally the end of the book. The other Gospels don't have anything like that. very unique. But what's the most unique is what's within the pages between that prologue and that appendix or epilogue at the end. And that is how many things that John has in terms of what Jesus did, and especially in terms of what Jesus taught, that isn't found in the other three Gospels. We have the great I am sayings only in John. I am the bread of life. I am the water of life. I am the light of the world. I'm the door to the sheepfold. I'm the good shepherd. I am the resurrection and the life. I am the way, the truth, and the life. You don't find any of that in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Why is that? John didn't tell us why. But here's my conclusion and the conclusion of many others. By the time John writes, the other three Gospels are probably already in circulation. And whether he had personally seen all three of them or not really doesn't make any difference. He knew what was in them because, of course, he was there when those things happened. But those other writers are now gone. And the eyewitnesses are becoming fewer and fewer. But there's still some things that need to be told. While an eyewitness and an apostle and an intimate disciple of Jesus is still alive. So he writes his gospel to present additional evidence for early believers as well as early unbelievers to consider about how we know that Jesus was actually God incarnate. So I'm really looking forward to the next 11 weeks after this one on Wednesday night that we can look at these things together. So I just encourage you to start reading the Gospel of John. I know if you get an audio copy of the Gospel of John, they read the entire Gospel in about 2 hours and 15 to 2 hours and 30 minutes. So it can't be all that tough. I mean, I might read slower than some or most, but even I could get through that. So start reading the Gospel of John, especially the first 11 chapters. That'll help you be more familiar with what we'll be talking about starting next week. Thank you very much.